adrenaline that, along with his discipline, had moved him forward without pause for the past 20 hours, had now given out, and all that remained was the discipline. He needed rest and hoped to find a few hours of it up the steep road in Guarda. By 4:10, the snowfall had picked up. Court was up the hill and in the village now. He saw not a single soul, though there were still some lights on in the little hotel. The lights of the homes of the villagers were all extinguished. The shepherds and the blacksmiths and the innkeepers and the pensioners were sound asleep for a few hours more. He continued on, still climbing higher through the village, past ancient stone water troughs for the sheep flocks that moved through the hamlet's pedestrian-only streets, past the tiny gardens surrounded by tiny fences in front of the tiny homes, until he broke out the other end of town and climbed higher up the steep hill along a dirt path. The evening snow settled on earlier accumulation, and it nearly blanketed the hillside, though even in the moonless night, gentry could see patches of darkness, bare spots on the prominence that had yet to accept the cover of the white powder. After climbing through the white meadows for 300 yards above Guarda, gentry clicked on his small tactical flashlight. Behind him was sheer pasture land, but he was now entering a pine forest, and the snow swirling through the trees and the black night made the road invisible ahead of him. The light helped. He pressed forward another 100 yards and found his destination in the woods, a tiny shack. It stood 30 yards from the road, which continued on and up through disused private property. There was no reason anyone else would pass by, and no reason, if someone did, that they would look hard to their right through the forest and notice the simple structure. A huge, rusty padlock hung uninvitingly on the front door. The three windows around the one-room shack were boarded from the inside, and surrounding pines grew unfettered nearly to the edges of the building. Gentry walked through the trees and circled the building with his tack light. At the back of the cabin stood a utility shed, also heavily padlocked, and he checked this and found it secure. Continuing around the structure, he scanned the walls, the wooden slats on the roof, and finally, the front door. He took off his gloves, ran his fingers around the door's edges slowly, and, in the top right corner, he found it. A wooden toothpick jabbed flush with the frame. Had the door been opened, this telltale would have dropped to the ground and given the gray man the tip-off that his cabin had been compromised by visitors. Satisfying himself that the location was secure, Court next turned his back to the front door, took 30 measured steps away into the pines, pushing through the needled branches. At 30 paces, he shifted 5 yards to his right and knelt down. The key was buried in a metal coffee tin, just 6 inches or so below the pine mulch and frozen dirt. He dug it out with a flat rock. After retrieving the key, he returned to the cabin and opened the lock. The interior air was dry and stale and every bit as cold as outside the door. There was a knee-high coal furnace in a corner, but Gentry ignored it. Instead, he lit a lantern on a card table in the center of the room, its dim glow the only warmth to be had. A shelf on the wall held cases of military rations, meals ready to eat, and the 36-year-old American tore into the first MRE he could grab as soon as he came out of the restroom with the chemical toilet. He ate hard crackers and cookies, wolfed them down as he sat alone at the card table. He finished his meal in 90 seconds. Next, he stood and pushed the squat coal furnace out of the corner and lifted the loose floorboards below it. Placing the tactical light in his mouth, he climbed down a wooden ladder exposed with the removal of the floorboards into a dirt-walled basement 6 feet high and 10 feet square. When he turned from the ladder, he faced 3 chest-high stacks of black cases, each case the size of a very large toolbox. This took up nearly half the room in the underground cellar, and a metal workbench filled the space to his right. There was only room to climb up and down the ladder and move sufficiently to manipulate the cases. Court hefted the first container off the first stack, dropped it heavily on the table, and flicked open the latch. Early that morning, when Court told Fitzroy he would rescue his family, he immediately decided to go to Guarda, Switzerland, to his massive weapons cache hidden in the forest. He had a half dozen other stores around the continent, but nothing like Guarda. Guarda was the motherlode, the heavy metal. The first case housed a black Swiss Brueger Antomet MP9 submachine gun. He pulled it out of its foam bed and snapped a loaded magazine into the magwell, affixed the sling to its buttstock, and lifted it over his head to push it outside the trap door onto the floor above him. Another case held a subload, a nylon and canvas rig full of loaded magazines for the weapon that would strap both to his thigh and his utility belt. He tossed this through the hole above him as well. For the next 5 minutes, Court went through case after case. Into a huge duffel, he stuffed all manner of small arms and explosives. Into a smaller bag, he placed a black tactical suit, a face mask, ballistic eyewear, a small surveillance scanner that would allow him to pick up short-distance communication, and a pair of binoculars. Finally, just before 5 a.m., Gentry climbed out of the basement, following behind the two duffels he pushed out in front of him. He left the entrance to the basement cache open. He drank from a half-frozen water bottle, washed down a couple of mild painkillers for his thigh, used the chemical toilet a second time, and pulled a sleeping bag from a shelf. He rolled it out on the floor, unlocked the latch of the front door, prepared the cabin's defenses a bit, and then climbed inside his bedding. He set the alarm on his watch to 7:30. A couple hours sleep would have to be enough to get him through another long day. They came for him just after 5. The minivan slid to a stop at the bottom of the hill. To the passengers, it seemed as if the driver had been out of control on the slick streets for virtually the entire 2.5-hour drive from Zurich. The driver's lack of skill in such conditions was understandable. There was black ice on the road, and the visibility was next to nil at times. Plus, these Middle Easterners' orders were to get onto the blinking dot on their GPS as fast as possible, and the tech was calling them on the satellite phone every 10 minutes for an update. There were 5 of them. Libyan external security officers from the Jamahiriya Security Organization, a fire team from the best of Gaddafi's men. All ex-army commandos, each knew his Scorpion SAVZ-61 machine pistol like a trusted friend. The leader was 41, stern-faced, and bearded, dressed in civilian adventure attire like the rest of his team. He sat in the passenger seat, incessantly barked admonitions at the commando behind the wheel, unforgiving of the man, though all knew the driver was more accustomed to negotiating desert dunes in an armored jeep than he was icy mountain switchbacks in a minivan. Still, they made it to Guarda in good time and parked their vehicle in the lot by the train station at the bottom of the valley. The driver lifted the hood and quickly removed the distributor rotor and threw it into his gym bag, thereby rendering the vehicle useless until he returned. They then found the little road up the hill, spread their formation as wide as possible across it, and began their ascent on foot. Each man carried his little Scorpion in a gym bag with its stock folded and a backup pistol in a shoulder holster. Different operators carried different grenades and breaching charges as well. They all wore knit caps, heavy cotton pants, and the same black parkas, an expensive name brand associated with professional athletes. Also in their gym bags were night vision goggles. They remained stowed for now. The 5 Libyans climbed the steep, winding road to the village in the dark. They moved quickly and efficiently. Any passerby would know from their near uniformity and the severe facial expressions bobbing up and down in the vapor of their exhalations that they were up to no good. But no locals walked the hillside road at 5:30 in the morning in a snowstorm, so the Libyans arrived, undetected, into the cobblestone streets of the Swiss hamlet. Each operator also had a small handheld radio attached to his belt and connected to an earpiece. With a single command from their leader, they separated on the western edge of Guarda, continued individually to the east, each through a different little pedestrian passageway. This tactic ensured that anyone looking out their window would only see one of the men. If an alarm was raised and the villagers began to talk about strangers, they all might well think they saw the same individual. On the far end of the town, the kill squad reformed like a biologic entity, detached cells rejoining in a petri dish. The leader consulted his GPS and turned to the left at an unpaved track that continued from the ledge on which the tiny hamlet was situated, up the hillside and into the forest, only visible in the distance after they donned their night observation devices. The leader updated the team from the information on his GPS.
400 meters.
The snow had picked up even more. The swirling bands of flakes had turned to thickening sheets of falling white. The Libyans had seen snow before, during training in Lebanon or on other missions in Europe, but their bodies were wholly unaccustomed to this cold. 48 hours earlier, this very team of operators had sat in a Tripoli apartment working with an electronic surveillance detachment to try to locate the source of a ham radio broadcast emanating from the city that had made comments critical of Colonel Gaddafi. It had been nearly 100 degrees in that cramped room, so the cold of the eastern Swiss valley was a shock to their systems indeed. They almost passed the shack. Only the GPS coordinates provided by the tech had saved them from hours of wandering through the woods. By now, the scorpions were out of their gym bags. The bags were hanging from their backs. The weapons' folding stocks were deployed, and the guns were raised to the low, ready position. Stocks pressed against their shoulders, and sights just below the sightline of their night vision goggles. Each man took a careful position around the cabin. They reported in one by one. The leader was first.
One in position 10 meters from the door. No movement. The windows are shuttered. Two is with one. Three on the west side. One window shuttered. Four at east side. One window shuttered. Five at back. No windows, but there is a utility shed alongside the main building. A secure padlock on the outside. Nothing else back here.
The leader said,
Five, stay at the back. Find cover and be ready. Three and four, come to the front door. We will enter as a team. Understood.
Gentry slept dreamless in his sleeping bag next to the hole in the floorboards that led to the earthen basement. The pain meds had dulled the ache in his thigh and given him the respite needed to relax. His sleep was deep, restful, brief. The leader retrieved a fragmentation grenade from his belt. He pulled the pin and moved slowly to the front door with his hand on the spoon. Two was in front and preparing a breaching charge when he noticed the door was not completely shut. He turned to his leader and motioned to the crack in the door. The leader nodded, turned to the two men behind him, and whispered,
It's open. Get ready.
Number two pushed the door open quickly and knelt down so that other weapons could train on any targets inside. It was completely dark at first. Even the night vision equipment could not make out the features inside. One lobbed the grenade into the room underhanded. Two, three, and four stepped to the edges of the cabin to avoid the blast. The grenade left the leader's hand and disappeared into the dark, but the sound of the missile's impact with a hard surface came too early. As the leader made to turn away from the door, the grenade reappeared in his night vision goggles, bounced out of the cabin, and landed in the snow in front of the door. Fortunately for the Libyans, all four saw the sputtering grenade in time. They dove for cover, either to the snowy ground or around the edges of the cabin. The explosion whited out the goggles of the three men facing in the weapon's direction, and a fourth man was hit in the elbow and knocked down by a small piece of shrapnel. Collecting himself quickly, the leader ripped his now useless goggles from his eyes, returned to the edge of the door, and entered, firing into the dark. Number two and then three followed, but within 2 seconds, the leader's shout made the others stop dead in their tracks.
Manthrap!
Chapter 17 Moments before Gentry had dropped exhaustedly to his sleeping bag for the night, he'd slid the large wall of rusty mesh to its position 2 feet inside the front door. The 7-foot-high contraption weighed over 200 pounds and slid along a 3-foot track on the floor. On each end of the fence, there was a hinged wing, and each wing locked to a clasp on either side of the door. This effectively created a barricade capable of slowing down a breaching team, forcing them to bottleneck at the most dangerous point of any breach, the doorway. The mantrap was here when Court inherited the cache, and he had not placed much value in its capabilities due to the fact that it could easily be blown apart with explosives or knocked over with a battering ram or even a few serious blows from a boot heel. But as he leapt out of his sleeping bag to a crouch after the grenade went off out the front door, he immediately knew the rusty old barricade had just saved his soundly sleeping ass. Frantically, he kicked the 2 duffels of gear by his sleeping bag back down the hole to the tiny basement. He grabbed the Brueger Antomette and fired a full magazine at the front door with one hand before sliding down into the hole. Once in the 6-foot-deep cellar, he reached above and pulled the floorboard lid over himself. Number 3 knelt over bloody snow to the left of the shack's entrance. The grenade fragment had hit him squarely in the elbow and passed through both meat and bone. But he was a disciplined soldier. He made little noise and quickly packed a handful of snow on the wound, wincing only with the shock of cold on skin, because he could not yet feel the pain he knew was soon to come. Number 1 ignored his injured man as he ordered 2 to set the fuse on his entire stock of breaching explosives and toss them through the doorway. A few seconds later, a tissue box-sized block of Semtex came to rest at the edge of the mantrap's slide rail on the floor. The 3 uninjured Libyans at the front of the shack turned to run, and numbers 2 and 4 each grabbed 3 under an arm and lifted him off the ground as they scrambled for cover. It was quiet in the black forest for a few seconds. The only sounds to be heard were the gentle hiss of snowflakes striking pine needles and their fallen brethren already on the ground, and the panting of the kill squad from Tripoli, now tucked tightly behind a fallen oak. The black night and the soft sounds were replaced with a white flash and an ear-splitting explosion that made the earlier hand grenade blast sound like the pop of a champagne cork. The doorway to the cabin, from the floor below to the slat roof above, blew to pieces, and lumber and fresh pine trees blew forward, landing as far away as 100 feet from the building. Bits of burning debris floated down with the snowfall through the pines as 1, 2, and 4 penetrated the wreckage of the cabin. Each man fired a burst or two as they entered the torn hole in the front wall. 1 went to the right, 2 to the left, and 4 moved straight through the small building. They used the light from burning fabric and paper to negotiate their footfalls over a blown-down metal fence, a smashed bookcase and table, several boxes and cooking utensils, and myriad unrecognizable objects. Once the 3 were sure there was no one alive in either the main room or the little bathroom, they began kicking over and through the debris on the floor, searching for the scorched and shredded body that surely must lie among the ruins. 5 checked in to confirm all was quiet at the back of the cabin, as the 3 Libyans inside began to worry. It was a small shack. Even in the deep shadows from the fires, it took less than 10 seconds to verify there was no body to be found. 1 looked to the ceiling. In a second, he determined there was neither a loft nor an attic. Slowly, he looked down to his feet.
There is a trap door here. Find it.
2 did find it, next to the overturned furnace, after kicking a few coal bricks away. The fires were burning themselves out, so 1 turned on an electric lantern that had fallen from a shelf but had miraculously survived the explosion. He placed it on the floor next to the trap door.
Careful. He may have set a surprise for us. Unless there is a tunnel through this mountain, he is trapped.
2 and 4 nodded. Their confidence grew. The gray man was hiding like a rat below them. Number 5 stood behind a thick pine at the back of the structure. 20 feet in front of him, was the padlocked storage shed. It stood 5 feet high alongside the cabin, but it was clearly not attached to it. He checked in with the men inside. They were about to lift the trap door with a long metal pole. Then they would toss grenades in, follow that with rifle fire, and then finally climb down to cut off their target's head. Five was missing all the action. He cursed aloud at the snow around him. His scorpion waited at the low ready. Suddenly, he heard the coughing of an engine coming to life inside the cabin. No, not inside the cabin. In the storage shed. Just as his eyes moved down to the doors of the shed, a loud boom barked through the forest. The padlock blew forward and off, and the doors flew open wide. Number five had just begun to lift his submachine gun to his eye when the motor noise screamed, and a large figure launched into the air from the darkened recesses of the small shed. The young Libyan soldier had never before seen a snowmobile. The bullet